members of that group that introduced me to Alcoholics Anonymous and helped me to build a very solid foundation based on the principles of Alcoholics Anonymous. And I was able to grow in that group and move on and carry the message of AA and help others. So anyway, I took my last drink September 17th of 2000. So I just became an old timer a couple of weeks ago. Last week, as a matter of fact, I believe I've lost track of the days. Celebrated 20 years sober, and I'm 44 years old today. I got sober when I was 24 years old. And I'll tell you, at that time, I hadn't planned on living past the age of 30. I didn't think I'd make it that long. And if I happened to see the age of 30, I can guarantee you I would have been in a cage somewhere for a very long time, if not the rest of my life. So I'm very grateful for Alcoholics Anonymous, not only to be alive and to see the age of 44, but extremely grateful for the life that Alcoholics Anonymous has given me today. And I don't have any doubt in my mind, it's because of AA and the God of my understanding that I found through AA that I have the life that I have today, you know. And I tell you, it's totally different. The life that, you know, I think about, you know, the old cliche of the life that I always dreamed of or whatever. And, you know, and I used to hear that early on, and I used to think, well, geez, the life I always dreamed of was winning the lottery and having a bunch of money, all this material stuff and living the good life and all that. And, you know, yeah, it'd be great to have all that stuff and not have to worry about financial responsibilities and stuff. But I tell you, I sponsored a guy one time that had in and out of Alcoholics Anonymous for over 20 years. And he had all that. He had plenty of money. He worked hedge funds. He worked on hedge funds and handled a lot of money. He made a lot of money, and he had a beautiful wife. He had four beautiful children. He had a $500,000 home over in a neighborhood here in Richmond called Tarrington. And could not get sober, couldn't stay sober. And I don't know what he's doing today. That was probably 8 or 9 years ago when I sponsored him, and he had been in and out for 20 years at that point. So it's not about having all that stuff. I know that today. And, you know, we were talking earlier before the meeting. I have a son today and a wife today, and I never wanted to have children. I never wanted to be married, and I would have sold myself short. I would have missed out on, you know, aside from sobriety, the biggest part of my life today. We went and spent the weekend down at the beach this past weekend down in Duck. My mother-in-law has a condo down there, and my wife and I don't really like to get out in the summertime very much. I don't know if you can tell, but I'm pretty pale. I don't agree with the sun, and my wife doesn't either. So we wait until late after the season's over when it's not so busy down there, and we like to go down there and spend a weekend, typically in the fall or the winter or early spring, before it gets real hot. But anyway, we took our son down there and spent the weekend and got him to go down, and man, he just loved it, playing in the sand. I bought him this little Tonka toy dump truck and bulldozer, and he's out there pushing it around and filling the truck up with the dozer in the sand. And I went and bought him a Buzz Lightyear kite, and we went down to Jockey's Ridge, and we're flying the kite Sunday and stuff. And I'll tell you, just a smile on his face, it lit me up, man. And just to be present in that moment at that time and not have to think about work on Monday or missed emails or not to think about any of that stuff, but just to be mentally and physically right there in that present moment. And I can't tell you what a gift that is. And to me, that is the absolute most valuable thing that I have in my life today. And it's my time. And the most valuable portion of my time is when I can be right here, right now, in the present moment. And not thinking about yesterday or not thinking about tomorrow, but just to be right here, right now. And what a gift that is. And I owe that all to Alcoholics Anonymous and the God of my understanding and the God that y'all introduced me to through taking the 12 steps. Anyway, I'm going to tell y'all a little bit about what my drinking was like, what happened, and what my life is like today, and how I come to have this relationship with this power greater than myself. I didn't grow up in a God household. I grew up, my father had left, and I grew up my mother and a stepfather, and there was some physical abuse and mental abuse in the home. And And I lived in fear most of the time. And my earliest memories, I'm no different than anybody else. My earliest memories were just not fitting in, you know, just feeling out of place, feeling out of sorts, feeling different than the other kids on the playground or feeling different than the other kids on the school bus. I was always a short little chubby kid. And my parents, I grew up poor. My parents didn't have money. So, you know, I had like three pairs of pants that I had to wear throughout the week and hopefully not get them dirty, you know, so I could wear them a second time. And, you know, my parents couldn't afford name brand stuff. And I always felt less than because I didn't have that stuff. And, you know, I always felt like I had to measure up to the other kids and I never quite measured up. I wasn't good enough. I didn't have the right skin color. You know, the guys I hung around had, you know, go out in the sun and go to the beach and get tan. And I just burned like a lobster. And anything that I could look at and compare myself to you, I never measured up no matter what. And I just wanted to fit in. I just wanted to be accepted. And like I said, my father left when I was around 5 years old, 5 or 6 years old. And my dad left my mom. And I got a brother that's 13 months older than I am. And I have a sister that's 8 years younger than I am. And so when my dad left and ran off with this other woman and left my mom take care of my brother and I. And he just left in the middle of the night one night. I mean, I woke up the next morning. I was like, where's dad? And mom had to tell me he was gone. And I'm like, well, he didn't even say goodbye. You know, and immediately right there, that got my mind to thinking, you know, like, why doesn't my dad love me? And that was it. That was like a theme throughout my whole, you know, my whole life, like into my adult years, even into early sobriety. Like, why doesn't my dad love me? What's wrong with me? Why am I not good enough for my own father to love me? And so anyway, my mother couldn't afford to take care of us. So she contacted my dad and told him that she had to send, you know, he had to come get my brother and I. And he was living up in Connecticut with this woman that he ran off with. She was younger. She was in the Navy. And so they came down and picked me and my brother up and took us back to Connecticut. And I didn't want to be there. But I remember having my first drink up there. I was about 7 years old or something like that. And this woman, my father worked 24 hours on and 24 hours off. And the strange woman sat my brother and I down. She gave us a little 7 ounce pony bottle of Miller High Life. And she sat us down and gave us that beer. And she started to tell us all these stories, you know, about her getting drunk and going out to bars and getting in fights with these guys. And I just remember feeling very excited. And at that particular time, and I don't know if it was that beer, or if it was just the fact that this adult figure was telling us these stories, you know what I mean? And here I am just this kid. And I just felt, you know, I was included and a part of something at that time. And I got done with that beer and I remember asking her if I could have another one. And she said no. And then she proceeded to tell us in graphic detail about how a man and woman reproduced. Now, I don't know about you, but if you're that age and you're listening to those details, like that's probably pretty disturbing to any normal person. But I didn't find it disturbing at all. You know, I just felt like I was like included, you know, like here's this adult person that's in a position of authority over me and including me in, you know, helping me to feel a part of something. So anyway, like I said, I didn't want to be there. I wasn't close to my dad growing up, and I was more of a mama's boy. I'm still a mama's boy today. I love my mom to death, and I wanted to come back to Virginia. And my mom had started dating a man who later became my stepfather, and who became the man that raised me. So they drove up to Connecticut, and they picked me up, and my brother decided he wanted to stay up there with my dad, and I came back to Virginia to live with my mom, and within a couple of months, we had lost contact with my father. He had moved, and I had no phone number, how to get a hold of him, no address. I was still in touch with his family, my grandparents, his mother and father, but they wouldn't divulge that information. They wouldn't give it to us or anything. So as a couple of years went by, with absolutely no contact with my dad and my brother at all. My mom ended up finding my brother through the Missing Children's Bureau and found out that they were living down in South Carolina at the time. The woman my father was with had been transferred down there. And so we go down there and get a lawyer and go to court. My mom just wants visitation rights to her son. She's not asking my dad for child support for me or anything. My stepfather was taking care of that. He didn't want any, you know, he didn't ask for any of that stuff. He was more than happy to do that. And So she just wanted visitation rights to see her other son and for me to see my brother. And evidently there had been a lot of problems with my brother up until that point. Growing, he had been in and out of some foster homes and got in some trouble with the law early on, and ended up coming back to Virginia to live with us. And there was just a lot of problems. There was a lot of resentment in the household. And while we were down there in South Carolina, the judge made us go see this family counselor down there. And I'll never forget this, a really nice woman. Her name was Jackie Dolphin. And I remember being in the room with her, with my dad, and she told me, you know, this is a safe place. You can ask your dad anything you want. And I only had one question for him. And the only question I had for him was, why hadn't he kept in touch with me? And basically what he told me is that in order to keep peace in his home with his new wife, she didn't want him having any contact with my mother. So he had to totally cut me out of his life, because he couldn't take the chance of even calling and having my mom answer the phone and having to have a conversation with her, because his new wife didn't want him having any contact with her at all. So I sat there and I listened to that information, and I showed absolutely no sign of emotion whatsoever. My facial expression didn't change. I didn't tear up, no body movements or anything. And that doctor came out and told my mom after that meeting, she said, I've never heard a child Jeremy's age listen to that information to show absolutely no sign of emotion at all. And as she suggested, my mom get me some help. So, you know, I learned early on to stuff feelings that made me feel uncomfortable, feelings that made me feel weak, feelings that made me feel vulnerable. I learned to stuff that stuff down really early on, because I felt like they made me not good enough and not strong. And I didn't like feeling that way. It was very uncomfortable to feel afraid and to feel weak, though I didn't know that's what I was feeling at that time. So anyway, my brother came back to live with us. There was a lot of problems in the household. My stepfather was very physically abusive. There was some abuse in the home, and we walked on eggshells. You know, it was all depending on the mood when Dad got home, and what was going to happen and stuff like that. So I was very rebellious. My brother and I both, we got in a lot of trouble. I was very mischievous, and I got in a lot of trouble being very, very manipulative and very sneaky. I got drunk for the first time when I was 12 years old, and I just remember being out with a couple of buddies of mine, and we got somebody to buy us a 12-pack of beer outside of 7-Eleven, went and sat in some woods behind a Pizza Hut out on Lynnhaven Parkway in Virginia Beach and drank those beers. And I just remember for the first time in my life just feeling at ease, you know, feeling like I could breathe, feeling like I didn't, like I fit in, not looking at these two guys, feeling like I was any less than or any better than, and not worried about what they thought about me or what other people thought about me. I was just able to breathe and able to laugh. And I had four beers. That was it. It was a 12-pack. There's three of us. We split it up equally. And I don't remember going home thinking, God, I can't wait to do that again. I don't remember going home and waking up the next morning thinking, God, I can't wait to do that again. Let me go get drunk today. That just wasn't my experience. I was 12 years old at the time. And over the next couple of years, I drank when the opportunity presented itself. I can tell you that if somebody brought it up, mentioned getting drunk or something, I didn't turn it down. I didn't say, no, I can't do that. You know, it was always, yeah, and let's figure out a way to make it happen. And I ended up some mornings I was going to 7-Eleven and shoving a bottle of Mad Dog down my pants. And I feel like this year has been karma for all, any of y'all that drank Mad Dog, this year is karma for that. All that stuff that we did drinking that stuff, that Mad Dog 2020, man, here it is. 2020 is coming back to bite us all. When I walk out of 7-Eleven, with a bottle shoved down my pants, I go to the bus stop, man, my buddies would chug it down real quick, and I go to school drunk, and I'm in like the 7th and 8th grade. And I remember getting into high school. That didn't change. That behavior didn't change. I'd moved to a new neighborhood out in Virginia Beach, and I grew up out in Bayside and graduated from Bayside High School. I live right across the street in Arizona Village, right behind the 7-Eleven, right there on the corner across the street from the high schools. And I would go into that 7-Eleven, and I would shove about a 40-ounce down my pants, and I'd walk outside and go hang out on the side of 7-Eleven. I'd drink that 40-ounce down, and I'd go to school, and some of my friends would see me in the morning before first bell, and like, have you been drinking? I was like, yeah. And I just thought I was cool. You know, I just wanted to fit in. And that's what alcohol did for me. Alcohol took away, you know, all those fears that I had, all those insecurities that I had. It just allowed me to fit in. It allowed my head to stop or slow down for a moment to where I wasn't focused on what you thought about me. I wasn't worried about what you thought about me. I wasn't worried about what happened, you know, yesterday or last week or last year that caused me so much embarrassment and shame or guilt and remorse. And I wasn't worried about what's going to happen tomorrow or next week or next month or next year, making plans of how, what I needed to do or who I needed to be in order to impress you. I was able to just be in the moment and to be able to relax and enjoy myself and have my mind, you know, quiet at that particular time. And that time span in my mind was able to stay, you know, quiet in the moment. The longer I drank, the more I drank, the longer I drank, the shorter that time span got. And at the end of my drinking, it was like sometimes it didn't even exist. Other times it would be there momentarily, but it was soon lost. So I did very well in school up until the 10th grade. I was a straight A and B honor roll student. I played sports. I played music. I did extracurricular stuff. I was, you know, a teacher's pet, if you will. I was very good in class, other than a few incidences where I got in a lot of trouble for disobeying a direct order, being disrespectful to authority. I don't like being told what to do. I don't like authority. I didn't like my parents telling me what to do, more or less a teacher. And I definitely didn't like the law telling me what to do. And you'll see that here coming up very shortly. I had a few little small run-ins with the laws of juvenile, stealing. I got caught stealing when I was 12, stealing some keychains out of Spencer's. You know, and I stole those keychains because my buddy was with me and he stole some keychains and I wanted to fit in. You know, I didn't want to look like a wimp, you know, in his eyes. I didn't want to be made fun of because I wasn't doing what he was doing. I remember stealing when I was like 8 or 9 years old, went up to the 7-Eleven, me and my buddy that lived down the street, and just stealing Mad magazines and skateboard magazines, Thrasher magazines and stuff, you know, and the packs of Garbage Pail Kid cards, you know, I used to collect those when I was a kid and I'd steal those and, you know, candy bars or whatever. And I started smoking when I was like 11 or 12 years old and stealing cigarettes. They used to leave cigarettes out in the wide open until they started putting them behind the counter because of people like me. And I mean, I'd walk in there and steal a couple cartons at a time. By the time I was in high school, I'd just throw a couple cartons down my pants and walk right out. I used to have one of those big old fat, triple fat goose coats. I had the fur around the collar, the big old inside pocket, man. I could fit $100 worth of stuff in that coat in 7-Eleven. I'd walk out of there sometimes. And I did all that stuff just to impress people, you know? I mean, I would go to school. I was in high school and I would stand outside the lunch line and bum change from people. Lunch was like 85 cents and, you know, they'd have a dollar and I'd stand outside and collect their 15 cents. And some days I'd get enough to buy lunch and some days I wouldn't. I had a job in high school. I had money, but my money had to go towards buying booze and drugs. You know, I smoked a lot of that green stuff and I sold a lot of that stuff when I was in school. And I couldn't come off 85 cents to buy a damn chicken patty and some fries, man. Come on. I'm standing out there bumming your change. I'm going to tell you, that's just the kind of guy I am. And anyway, I somehow managed to graduate high school in 1994. I started working at a restaurant when I was 15 and started washing dishes. And that was in 10th grade. 15, 16, something. I started washing dishes and I washed dishes in that restaurant for about 8 months, I believe. And then they moved me up and they put me on taught me how to be a fry cook. And by the time I was a senior in high school, I was a nighttime manager in that restaurant. And there were certain things that only I was allowed to fix. The owner of that restaurant wouldn't allow other people to prep. And a place down there called Surf Rider. Some of y'all may be familiar with it. I used to work for Stanley and Chris Bennett, and I tell you, some of the best crab cakes around, man. And they used to have a place over at Haygood. It used to be Haygood before they opened up the one in Cypress Point. It's a Plaza Azteca now. It's in Haygood Shopping Center down at the end corner, Independence. I think it's Independence right there. But it's Plaza Azteca. It used to be Surf Rider right there. And there was guys that – there were people that come in there. There was a guy that come in there every Monday night, and he always got a chicken salad sandwich. And he always said, did Jeremy make the chicken salad? And he wouldn't get it unless I made it. And I'll tell you, man, I was very good at what I did. And they, you know, the owners of that company saw that in me. And they employed me for a long time, well beyond what they should have employed me. because I was unemployable, and I would show up drunk, drunk high, and cause all kinds of problems in their restaurant with their other employees and stuff. And I mean, I was a jerk, man. I was a real big jerk. And, but they taught me how to cook, and I loved it. And so I graduated, you know, and I didn't really have any plans of going to college or anything. I just felt like I'm going to stay in the restaurant business, and, you know, I'm pretty good at what I do. And I'm, you know, they're going to open, they've already talked about opening another restaurant, and I'm going to go over there and be the manager. Now, they had never said anything to me about being the manager of that restaurant, but in my mind, I'd already made up my mind that I was going to go over and be a manager. And anyway, that was, I graduated June of 94. November 6th of 94 was a Sunday. I'd been out drinking with my buddies all day, and I went up to this pool hall. I don't know if any of y'all remember this out in Virginia Beach. Place used to be called Pockets Billiards. It used to be up on Virginia Beach Boulevard in front of Aragona up there. Anyway, I went up there drinking and got in a verbal altercation with a manager there. I carried over out to the parking lot. There's a group of guys and a group of people standing out in the parking lot, and I got behind the wheel of my car and I ended up running over one of those guys that was out there in that parking lot. And I kept going. And my girlfriend at the time, she was in the car with me, and she's screaming hysterically for me to stop the car and let her out. And I'm, you know, trying to calm her down and stuff. And anyway, there was a girl that worked there that was out there. I went to school with. I knew she knew who I was. I knew she saw me. So I ended up going home, waking my parents up, and I told them what happened. And I went up to the third precinct down in Independence and turned myself in. And I remember sitting out there on those steps, and the detective had come up. He had just, you know, they had received the call already. He had just come from the crime scene and come down there to let, you know, to take us in the precinct and question me and stuff. And I just remember sitting out there with my head in my hands, crying, and my dad was talking to the detective. And I just remember, you know, repeating to myself, the guy should have moved, the guy should have moved, the guy should have moved. There was like seven of them out there, and everybody got out of the way except for the one guy. And I hit him. So anyway, that was November 6th, November 8th, and they arrested me that night for a malicious wounding and took me to jail. And November 8th was my parents' wedding anniversary. And November 8th, they came and got me and took me back down in front of the magistrate, and they charged me with first-degree murder because the guy died in the hospital. So I am 18 years old, just out of high school, facing 20 years of life, and that wasn't part of my plan at all. I didn't have much of a plan, but I can tell you that wasn't part of it, whatever it was. And so I ended up sitting in there for about a month, and my parents borrowed a lot of money to hire me a lawyer and to bond me out. I had to have a bond hearing. They gave me no bond. I had to go to court and have a bond hearing. They bonded me out. My lawyer suggested I not drink and I not drive while I was out on bond. And I thought those were great ideas. They were great suggestions. I agreed 100%. So I smoked pot. And because I cannot be alone, totally sober in my own head, I have to have something. So I immediately start smoking pot and drinking a lot of O'Doul's. And I remember having the bright idea that, you know what, I'm not drinking alcohol. I'm just smoking pot. I'm perfectly okay to drive while I'm smoking pot. So I should drive my drunk friends around. I could be the designated driver since I'm just smoking pot and I'm not drinking alcohol. So nothing happens to them like it happened to me. So I start driving my drunk friends around for a little while, driving my buddy's car. And then I get the bright idea, well, screw it. I'm going to penitentiary for a long time. I may as well go ahead and enjoy myself. And I started drinking again. And I didn't know anything about the obsession to drink at that time. I didn't know anything about alcoholism at that time. I didn't know anything about the phenomenon of craving. I didn't know anything about the allergy that I have, that once I put alcohol into my body, something happens inside of me that makes it virtually impossible for me to stop or to control how much I'm going to drink once I start. I didn't know anything about the obsession. I didn't know anything about being powerless. I believe that I made the decision. Every drink that I took, I believe that I made the decision to take that drink. And I believe I made the decision to take every drink that ensued after that. I didn't understand people that only like to drink a couple and catch a little buzz. I'm starting to feel it. I'm like, well, that's the whole point, isn't it? You know, I didn't understand people that didn't drink and drive. Like, you know, one of those guys, like, you're not going to tell me what to do. I told you, I don't like authority. You know, I'm going to do whatever it is that I want to do. And so anyway, I'm drinking and driving again. I'm out on bond for, you know, running a guy over and killing him for behind the wheel of a car. And here I am out drinking and driving. I started to have some physical problems, vomiting blood and stuff. And I went to see my doctor, and he put me on Ambien. And So I started taking the antabuse. I'm seeing a therapist. I'm diagnosed with some mental stuff. I'm placing antidepressants and anti-anxiety medication. And I stopped taking the antabuse. I'm still smoking pot. I started drinking again. And my brother and I's relationship has never been very good. I mean, it's better today than it's ever been, but it was not good at that time. And it hadn't been good since he had come back to live with us. Like I said, there was just a lot of resentment there. So anyway, he and I didn't really get along. And this was before cell phones back. You know, I think I was cool when I had a pager. And I used to sell a lot of weed back then too. So, you know, if you wanted to buy weed, like you had to page me and put your little 3-digit code in. So I knew who it was. And I kept getting this page, and I'd go and I'd get on the phone and I'd call, and it was the number to the Tidewater Psychiatric Institute. And that happened to me a couple of times. I'm like, it's just weird. So anyway, I'm on the phone. My girlfriend and I are arguing one night, and she's over hanging out with my brother and my sister-in-law and stuff. My brother gets on the phone, and he tells me that he's the one that's been paging me, putting that number in, and told me I was crazy and I needed some help. And I got very angry and pissed off and threw the phone across the room that night. And I was at home with my mom and dad. And I tell you, my head was about to explode. My girlfriend and I weren't getting along. I'm just overwhelmed with so much fear. It was just unbelievable, unbelievable. And I ran out of my house that night, and I ran out in the middle of Arizona Boulevard in the middle of traffic and just started walking down the middle of the road in front of a car that was coming. My mom and dad fly out of the house behind me, and they're screaming at me and yelling at me and stuff. And I just really wanted to die. Like I just wanted to end it all. And I ended up going to detox that night, and I spent the night in detox. And the next day I'm sitting there, you know, the people are eating lunch, and again, I just felt out of place. I call my mom and tell them, come get me. I'm like, these people are crazy. You got to come get me out of here. And I probably should have stayed. I fit right in looking back. But anyway, I thought I was better than them, you know? And anyway, I leave there, I go home, and I try not to drink for a little while, and I'm just smoking pot again. I ended up going to court, and I have a pretty lengthy trial. I took a jury trial, and they found me guilty of second degree murder. And in the state of Virginia, second degree murder carries a minimum of 5 years and a maximum of 40 years. And that jury found it necessary to give me the minimum sentence in the state of Virginia, which is 5 years. And I committed my crime before they abolished parole, so I was under the old law, which meant I only had to do half of that time. And I don't know about you, but when they, you know, took me out of that courtroom in handcuffs and shackles, I turn around and my family is crying. My friends are crying. My mom had a nervous breakdown in the courtroom. My dad had to escort her out of there. And I don't understand why everybody's so upset, because I wanted to do cartwheels out of there. You know, I was facing a life sentence, and all I have to go do is serve 2.5 years. I mean, the piece of cake to me, man. And so they take me back, and I'm calling home every day for the next week and a half, 2 weeks. And try and get a hold of my mom. And every time I call, my dad answers or my aunt answers. And my mom's never there. She's always at the store or over so-and-so's, or she's always out. Anyway, after about a week and a half, 2 weeks, I call, and finally my mom answers the phone. I'm like, where have you been? I've been calling, trying to get a hold of you. And she went home from my trial, and she took a bunch of pills and tried to commit suicide. And my dad had her committed to the psychiatric institute. And this is, you know, when I first came in Alcoholics Anonymous, I believed that if I could just stop drinking, that my life would straighten out. I'd be able to show up and live a normal life if I wasn't drunk all the time. And there was this little redheaded woman named Renee. And I remember when I met Renee my first time at Craddock, she said, I got good news and bad news. The good news is you never have to drink again. The bad news is drinking ain't your problem. And she turned around and walked away. I thought, that woman's nuts. And if I could just stop drinking, I was going to be all right. And when my mom told me what happened, I wasn't apologetic. I wasn't the son that said, oh my God, mom, I am so sorry I caused you that amount of pain. I'm so sorry, mom, that I'm putting you through this. Those thoughts never occurred to me. What came to my mind was, how dare you when I need you the most? And what came out of my mouth was, mom, I need you right now. I need you to be strong for me right now. My life is all about me. It's not about anybody else. It's all about me. It's all about what you're supposed to do for me and what you're supposed to give me. And I didn't know that until I came into AA, and y'all helped me to see that. I ended up, I served my time. I did the best I could in there. I, I tried to keep my nose clean and stay out of trouble. And, you know, that lasted a couple of weeks, and I found my people and I started making wine and getting drunk and selling dope and getting high and doing all the, you know, the bad stuff you're not supposed to do while you're in there, getting rehabilitated to return to society. And I came out of there, worse than what I went in, you know, and my wife and I were talking today. And I, you know, we went down to the beach this weekend, and I packed up everything in the car we got home last night. We're putting my son to bed, and he's like, "Blankie, you want my blankie?" So I'm like, "All right, I run downstairs." I'm looking all over the house for it, and I can't find it. And I remembered when I was packing everything, he wanted his blankie, and I gave it to him, and I never went back to get it out of the condo. So his blankie's down at the beach last night. So we're putting him to bed. So anyway, I'm talking to my wife today and about, you know, making arrangements to go back down there to get it. She said, you should feel bad about that. I said, I did for a second last night. She said, you don't feel bad about anything. I said, every now and then I feel guilty. Like I said, I'm not going to lose any sleep over it for the next week. My wife's like really, you know, really one of them really guilt conscious Catholic girls, you know? So she carries that stuff with her. So, and I'm just not like that, man. You know, it's like, I came out, what little bit of conscience I had when I came out of that prison, like it was gone, man. I mean, it was gone. I came out, for lack of a better term, just a monster. I had absolutely no regard for human life. I didn't care about you. I didn't care about how I hurt you. I didn't care about what I took from you or what I did to you. I mean, I just did not care, man. And all I cared about was just partying and drinking and getting drunk. I had a year of parole and I drank. I got out and went back to the same crowd doing the same thing. I found another crowd doing a lot of other stuff, and I got real heavily involved in some narcotics. And I found out, you know, doing cocaine, it was out of your system in 72 hours. And, you know, I'd do a lot of cocaine. I wouldn't do it for 3 days before I had to go see my PO so I could give a clean urine. And I did that, somehow managed to make it off parole. And I got really, really hooked on that stuff really bad. And what that stuff allowed me to do is it allowed me to drink the way I wanted to drink. You know, I mean, I could drink for days on end on that stuff and not get sloppy, falling down drunk, puking all over the place and stumbling and all that stuff. But what it also did is it turned me into somebody. It turned me into somebody that it gives me chills looking back at who I was today, that what it did to me. And I became really, really violent for the next couple of years while I was out there drinking. And I got arrested for another assault charge at a bar I used to hang out at. I beat up a lawyer. And don't beat up a lawyer. You're going to go to jail. There's no getting out of that. Anyway, I did that. I go to jail. And when I got out of prison, you know, I started doing that stuff. And I caught myself getting a little bit out of hand. So I wanted to try to get myself under control of it. So I started dating a woman 17 years older than me that had 3 kids, because I figured that's what I needed to do, was settle down and be a family man. And I ripped and roared through her life and the life of her kids. And I used her up for the next 13 months. And poor woman. And I look back and I mean, it's terrible how I treated her. It's just absolutely terrible. And I'm not proud of that at all. Not one bit. I just became somebody unrecognizable to myself. You know, I always had this image of myself and wanted to be this tough guy, and I'm not a tough guy at all. Not then, not today, and I probably never will be. And I'm okay with that today. But I had this image and I wanted to be this tough guy. And when I was under the influence of drugs and alcohol, it allowed me to be that person. It allowed me to go well beyond that person, honestly. And I got in a fight with that lawyer. I went back to jail for that. I went back to, you know, that place, Pockets Pool Hall, that used to be up on Virginia Beach Boulevard. They had moved to a new establishment. It's burned down now, but there was, and I didn't do it, I tell you. They moved to another location. I forget now, somewhere off of Independence or something like that. But anyway, I was out with my brother and another buddy of mine, and we went up to that pool hall. One night we were out drinking, and this is shortly before my last drink. And we went out there, and the same manager worked there before. And it was owned by the same guy. The guy that owned the place, I actually knew his daughter. She went to a different high school, but we all ran with the same crowd and stuff. And she was up there working, and some other people that were still there. And And we walked in and immediately we were asked to leave. And that same guy was up there and we walked outside in the parking lot and I told him to come on out and step out in the parking lot and I'll make sure I put his, you know, 6 feet deep this time. Anyway, they pressed charges on me for that. I had warrants out for my arrest and I got arrested for threatening bodily harm and trespassing on that one. And I was out on bond for that. And I got for my final arrest, took my last drink September 17th. And I'll tell you, at the end of my drinking, my routine was, you know, I would stay up for 3 or 4 days drinking and doing a lot of other stuff and drinking around the clock. I was a 7-Eleven every morning at 6 a.m. waiting for him to unlock the beer coolers to buy more booze. And this particular day was no different. You know, my alarm clock was set for 9 o'clock in the morning. And that meant it was time for me to stop doing what I was doing and go in the bathroom and get myself ready to go to work. I didn't have a vehicle or a license or anything. And this little young girl I was dating from the restaurant, she would always come pick me up and take me to work or the owner of the restaurant, Stanley. Sometimes he would come get me and pick me up and bring me to work sometimes. And I tell you, those guys gave me a job long beyond what they should have. But I'm grateful for what they gave me. And then, you know, my routine was I my alarm would go off at 9. I'd stop doing what I was doing. I'd go in the bathroom and get myself ready to go to work. And I'd look at myself in the mirror and I didn't recognize who was looking back at me. And I'd look at myself in the mirror and I'd say, Jeremy, what the fuck are you doing? And I absolutely knew my life was going out of control. And I had absolutely no ideas or no way to stop it. I wasn't paying my bills. I had a car that got repossessed. I had some couple credit cards that were maxed out, credit card bills that hadn't been paid, some medical bills that hadn't been paid. I had been given an eviction notice to get out of the apartment that I was in. The apartment didn't have my name on it. It had my brother's name on the lease and this other girl that I'd moved in with. And anyway, he had already left. She'd already left. And he come home one night and I was in a blackout and he and I got into it. And he came the next day and packed his stuff and left. I had 2 weeks to find somewhere to live. I had no money. My mom and dad were done with me. I had nobody that would allow me to even spend one night on the couch. Guys that I used to run the streets with and drink with and party with and stuff didn't want to be around me. My behavior had become so violent and so unpredictable at that time that nobody wanted me to be around, And I don't blame them. I look back on that stuff. And at that time when it was happening, I'd always say, well, screw you. I don't need you anyway. You're just weak. You know, you're just weak. You can't handle it. You're not a man. You can't hang. And I look back on it today and thank God that they, you know, didn't have anything to do with me and they pushed me away for their own safety and for my own good. And September 17th, that day was no different than any other. I'd been up for a few days drinking and I called in. I was supposed to go in and help the general manager of the restaurant do inventory that day. And I called him and I told him I can't make it. I said, I'm not feeling good. I can't make it. I was at 7-Eleven at 6 a.m., 8 a.m. and 10 a.m. buying booze. And then 12 noon, I was down at Chicks Beach Cafe having some drinks with some friends of mine. And by 3 o'clock that day, I was sitting in a cage down at Virginia Beach Jail. And I figured once I went in that time, I figured with my record, I was going to serve at least 5 years and I was perfectly okay with that. Perfectly okay with that. I figured I could take that time, get my head straight, you know, and get my life back on track and get straightened up. I'm all right living behind bars. You know, it's not an ideal lifestyle, but you know, it was a better life for me than living out in society because I had absolutely no idea how to live out in society. So I ended up going in there and went to all my court dates except for one. I had one probation violation left to go to court for. And I went to all my court dates and somehow managed getting convicted of another felony, a couple misdemeanors, a couple violations. And I got like 7 or 8 years total. Most everything suspended except for a year and a half. I had to serve a year and a half. And I had one probation violation left and I was placed, they had taken me out of general population and put me in a therapeutic community that they have down there. And back then, and to be in that program, you had to be sentenced by a judge. And I was not sentenced by a judge to be in that program. And they moved me in there. And then the next day, the counselor came in and he had these files for everybody that had been moved in there the night before. And he called everybody out of the cell one by one and went over everything with them and stuff. And when he got done, he looked up, he said, who are you? I don't have any paperwork for you. And I said, you know, I told him my name and I said, I didn't ask to be here. And he's like, you want to stay or you want to go? I said, well, I think I'll stay because I think I have a problem. And it was from that point on that my life started to change. God, I'm sorry I ran over with the drunk log on and on and on. But I got introduced to Alcoholics Anonymous at that time. I was placed into that program, and I spent the next 14 months that I was in there. I spent the next 14 months in that program. And the guys that used to bring the meeting in there introduced me to Alcoholics Anonymous, and I started to read the big book and the 12 and 12 and all the AA literature in there. Couldn't quite get on board with AA Comes of Age yet. But I read Dr. Bob and the Old Timers. That was a great book, and loved Language of the Heart and reading the Grapevine articles and stuff from there. And the grapevines, devoured the grapevines. If you get the grapevine, please donate them to correctional facilities, man. I'll tell you, they saved my life in there. And there was this one guy in particular, a guy named Bill Campbell. He's from down there, that area. Some of y'all might know him, but Bill saved my life, man. Bill really gave me Alcoholics Anonymous. Bill always stood at the door, and he always gave me a hug, and he always told me he loved me. And he had a glow in his eye, and he was very soft-spoken, and he always had a smile on his face. And Bill sat beside me in that meeting, and he celebrated 20 years sober, sitting beside me in that meeting in a cage. And I'm sitting there thinking to myself, why is this man in here celebrating 20 years sober? Why isn't he out there at a real meeting showing everybody he's got 20 years sober? Because that's what I would, that's where my mind was at. Like, that's what I, and I'll tell you, I just celebrated 20 years sober. I would have given anything to go sit in that cage with those guys and celebrate 20 years. And because of everything that's happening right now, I'm not able to get into the facilities. I take meetings into prisons, been doing it for years now. And because of what's happening, I'm not able to do it. And I'm gonna tell you, there's a part of me that's dying inside because I can't do it. Those are my absolute favorite meetings. Those are the people that I connect with the most. And nothing against people in regular AA meetings, but my people are those ones that are in that cage. Like, those are my people. That's where my heart is at. And Bill brought Alcoholics Anonymous in there. And it's not taking anything away from those other guys, but Bill was the one that I connected with on there on a gut level. And I went, and when I got out, and I was able to go to Bill's home group, and I was able to be in Bill's home group and be a part of his own group when he celebrated 21 years on the outside. And I still stay in touch with Bill today. And we were teasing the other day, we were joking and chatting on Facebook. And, you know, he made a comment, I post all kinds of funny stuff. I got a very, very dark sense of humor, if you can't tell. But I post a lot of dark, funny, it's funny to me anyway. Some people don't find it funny. But I post a lot of, you know, what's funny to me on Facebook. And Bill always comes back and he goes, you know, sometimes I don't even have to look to see who posts the stuff. I already know it's you. but I started to get honest with myself in there, man. And I started to get an honest look at my life and my drinking. I'll tell you, I could see where I was powerless over alcohol. I started to read the doctor's opinion and started to relate to that stuff and could see the obsession in my life and see the allergy of how once I started drinking, it explained, you know, why I'd go out to the bar and I tell myself I'm going to leave by midnight and it's 6 a.m. and I'm at 7-Eleven waiting for them to unlock the beer cooler again, you know. I tell myself I'm leaving at midnight because I had to work, you know, I hadn't got any sleep the night before. I got to work a double shift tomorrow. I really need to get some sleep. I'm tired. But by midnight, like, that's it, man. My motor's on and I'm going. And I'm at 7-Eleven at 6 a.m. and I start to process all over again. And it explained a lot of that to me. It explained why, you know, my mom would find me in high school. She'd find me laid out in the backyard somewhere passed out. You know, or out in the driveway, passed out, leaned up against the garage with a empty bottle of tequila over in the neighbor's yard. You know, I never thought about what my neighbors thought of my parents growing up. All I thought about was me and drinking. And I couldn't come in the house all hours of the night. You know, my dad wouldn't let me in the house when I was drunk. And I'd just pass out in the yard. I was like, screw it. And then the thought never occurred to me, well, maybe I shouldn't be out drinking. You know, I was going to drink no matter what. It didn't matter what the consequences were. So I got out of there, and I got out February 25th of 2002, and I got busy, man. I got busy in Alcoholics Anonymous. I went to meetings every day. I got a sponsor, Mark G. Some of y'all know him. I think he lives down in Virginia Beach now. He used to live in Deep Creek. Then he moved out to the West Coast. Then he come back, lived in Hampton, and now he's over in Virginia Beach now. But anyway, he was my first sponsor. He took me through those 12 steps, and we sat down and we read that book, and when it said to pray, we pray, and when it said to write, we wrote, and he taught me, he showed me what it meant to give freely of what was given to him. And I remember one particular experience. My mom had had a health scare and had to be rushed to the emergency room with some heart stuff. And I remember calling my sponsor. I just remember early on, everybody always told me, don't be afraid to pick up the phone and call. Don't be afraid to pick up the phone and call. And when I got that phone call from mom, I called my sponsor. And this is back before cell phones. And I left a message on his home voicemail at his house. And it was a Saturday. And I figured, let's find out. He'll be at the home group tonight. You know, he's always at the home group, never missed the home group. And he'll be at the home group tonight, and I'll just talk to him then. So anyway, I go to the home group that night. Well, he's not there. And I'm thinking to myself, what am I going to do now? You know, because I was still, you know, in my mind, afraid to talk to somebody else, you know. And I talked to this other guy, John, when I got there in a little bit. But I really needed my sponsor at that time. So I'm sitting there during the meeting. I'm all up in my head and stuff. I'm going crazy. I can't remember anything from the meeting. But I remember after the meeting, I remember walking outside Craddock, and Mark was out there. And he had been out on a date, and he got home and he listened to his messages, and he said, I heard the tone in your voice and I knew I needed to come talk to you and I wanted to be here. And I can't tell you how much that meant to me, you know, for somebody to just drop what they're doing and to be there for me like that. And he showed me the love that we have here in Alcoholics Anonymous, the unconditional love. And he taught and he showed me what it meant to lay aside what's going on in my personal life, to be there for somebody else. And I wish I could, you know, I wish I could do that. I'm not saying I don't do that kind of stuff for other people. I do. But like him and Bill, if you know those two guys, you know the giving that's in them. You know their hearts. If you know those two guys, you know their hearts. And my sponsor here today, some of you know him, Bob Sangster, you know his heart. And those are the guys that I've had leading me. Jim Willis was my sponsor for a long time from down there in Chesapeake. And I got in good with Jim and his crowd, with the guys in North Carolina, with Tom and Steve and stuff, and got really involved in corrections work. And I'll tell you, those guys are my heroes in Alcoholics Anonymous. And I tell you, for a guy like me, my wife will tell you, I even to this day, I told my wife, I said, I cannot generate feelings of sympathy. I cannot generate feelings of concern. I just don't make a conscious decision to feel that way. You know, they're either there or they're not. And even when they're not there, I can act differently. And I've learned to do that in Alcoholics Anonymous. But if the feelings aren't there, like, I can't make those feelings happen. And I'm just not somebody that has a lot of that. And I'm okay with that today. I used to think there was something wrong with me, you know. And one of my sponsors early on, Richard, you know, Richard and I used to have this joke, like, I'd get a twinge of empathy for somebody, and he'd start laughing. He's like, I know, it's weird, ain't it? I'm like, yeah, it really is weird to feel empathy for somebody. Like, that's not normal for me. And so when it comes today, I recognize what it is, and I grasp a hold of that, and I thank God for that feeling, because it's not every day that stuff comes for me. And but it's okay today. It's okay, because I've been taught to act better than I feel. Anyway, I went through the steps. I got involved with service. And, you know, if you're a member of the Credit Study Group, you don't have much choice. And I got thrown right into service work, man. I tell you, I loved it. I loved everything about Alcoholics Anonymous. And I moved on from that group, got involved with the Young People's Group, started sponsoring a bunch of guys. And at 5 years sober, I wanted to blow my brains out. You know, I was running around throwing a big book at everybody, wanting to be the poster child for Alcoholics Anonymous, telling everybody, you know, how they were doing it wrong. Guys that were sober 20 years longer than me, and not talking about the big book and quoting the big book, and, you know, doing everything that I was doing in Alcoholics Anonymous. They weren't doing it that way, and I was telling them they were wrong. And going home and being the loneliest person, being more lonely than I was when I was drinking, and couldn't figure out why and what was going on. Ended up having a breakdown one night. And I went up to the new meeting at Craddock. My grand sponsor, Jack, was going to be up there. And I knew that he was there every single day. Old One-Eyed Jack sitting up there at the front table on the right-hand corner up there. He had his seat. And I knew he was going to be there. And I went up there and I said, sat down, I said, Jack, I'm going crazy. And you know how Jack is? Figures. And sitting there through the meeting, I thought, you crotchety old man. And I remember one day I was sitting out on steps in front of the Craddock one Saturday night. Jack walked up and said, how you doing? I said, man, I'm doing great, man. It's been great. You know, I've had a great few days. And he's like, this too shall pass. And he kept on walking. I thought, you son of a bitch. And the next day, sure enough, man, I was irritable, restless, discontent, all crazy. I thought, that's all Jack's fault. And anyway, I knew Jack was going to be up there that day. I went up there. I said, Jack, I'm going nuts. He goes, figure, sit down. Anyway, I hung out with Jack after the meeting that day, and I started to get honest with some of those guys in my home group, tell them really what was going on, and, you know, quit trying to hide the fact that, you know, I'm 5 years sober and I'm batshit crazy. You know, I'm 5 years sober, and I'm still relying on women and relationships and money and material stuff and how you treat me in order to feel good about myself. And what I found out was God was able to remove that obsession to drink, and he was powerful enough to help me to stay sober, but God was also powerful enough to relieve me of all those other faulty dependencies. All that other outside stuff that it talks about in We Agnostics that I depend on to feel complete on the inside, to quiet my mind, to allow me to have that moment, that one moment, those few minutes or few seconds, whatever it is, that I can be with my son and be in the present moment and not be thinking about yesterday or thinking about tomorrow, but just to be here, to be still, and to be right here with you, with God, right here, right now. And I started to take a look at that stuff, and over the next few years, my life was up and down. I got involved in a relationship with a newcomer girl up here in Richmond, and we did the long-distance things for a couple of years. I ended up moving up here in 2009, moving in with her, and we got engaged and had plans on being married, and that relationship didn't work out. And I met my wife. My wife was the babysitter over at Jay Walker's, and I'd known her, and we started talking and stuff, and we dated for a long time, and my wife taught me how to date like a normal person, you know, not to just jump in the sack and move in with each other, you know, 2 weeks later because we're in love and going to spend the rest of our life together. You know, she taught me what it was like to get to know somebody, you know, before there was any kind of physical affection at all. And she taught me how to get to know each other and to spend time with each other and see what we have in common and talk about what we, you know, want for our life and stuff like that, to see if we're compatible, what it meant to be compatible, you know, before we took that next step and became physical, you know, and that's all my wife's doing. That's not my doing. That's my wife's doing, I tell you. And so anyway, we dated for, you know, a year, and she said she wanted to get married. And I told you, I didn't want to get married. She wanted to have kids. I didn't want to have kids. I said, all right, I'll get married. And anyway, I asked her to marry me on December 25th of 2014. And we got engaged December 25th, 2014. We got married April 25th of 2015. We bought our, signed our mortgage and bought our first house, the house I'm in now, on June 25th of 2015. So everything was pretty quick, boom, boom, boom. And, you know, then she wanted to start practicing and having a baby. So we lost one due to a miscarriage, and my son was born January 4th of 2018. And I'll tell you, I stood there with my wife every step of the way. I got a job today, a career way out of the field that I went to, you know, I put myself through school to become a certified welder. And I'm about to wrap it up real quick. I wanted to be a welder, and I was a welder for a good number of years. And one of my friends owns a fence company, and he offered me a job. And I'm over there today, and I've been given three promotions, and I'm in a position today. I have a career. And at one time, when my wife, at the end of my wife's pregnancy, I told her she was high risk, and I had a job. I was running the job out in Roanoke, Virginia, and I drove back and forth from Richmond to Roanoke every day for about 5 or 6 weeks straight, I think. And I was leaving the house at 4:30 every morning and getting home between 7 and 8 o'clock every night, just because I didn't want my wife to be at home alone there at the end of her pregnancy. And I stood right there with her in the labor room and held her hand and counted while she, you know, did the pushing and the breathing and all that stuff. And I watched my little son being born, and I watched my son and my wife almost die, both of them. And all I could do was sit there and hold my son's little hand and just say prayers, where's mommy, while all the doctors and nurses were over there, you know, trying to make sure that her heart was going to stay pumping. My wife has POTS, and it's very severe. And he's perfectly healthy, and he's the happiest little boy I've ever seen in my life. And, you know, my wife still has her ups and downs, and with everything happening today, we have to be very careful because of her health stuff. And she's very high risk, and the precautions that we have to take. But I tell you, I wouldn't give up my life today for anything. And I owe all that to Alcoholics Anonymous and what you taught me. The steps that you taught me and the principles that you taught me to live by that enabled me to have a relationship with the power greater than myself, because I didn't grow up with that power in my life. You know, I was taught one thing, but it was never practiced in my home. And I was never taught how to practice that. And you taught me how to practice that. You taught me how to give of myself and what was so freely given to me. So thank you.
Wow, Jeremy, thank you so much. Everybody, you have the ability, you should have the ability to unmute and thank our awesome speaker.
Thank you, Jeremy. Love you, brother.
Love you, man. Thanks for having me.
That was awesome. That was so good. I'm going to scroll down here. It seems like it's doing that thing where it says they can unmute themselves, but they cannot, just like it did last week. I believe David posted the PayPal link in the chat. The seventh tradition states that every AA group ought to be fully self-supporting, declining outside contributions. Contributions cover each group's rent and other expenses. The seventh tradition is essential at every level of AA service. It is both a privilege and a responsibility for groups and members to ensure that not only their group, but also their inner group, central office, local services, district area, and the general service office remain self-supporting. This keeps AA free of outside influences that might divert us from our primary purpose, help the alcoholic who still suffers. Our common welfare, a word about safety. Your safety is our group endeavors to provide a safe meeting place for all attendees and encourages each person here to contribute to fostering a secure and welcoming environment in which our meetings can take place. I can take a couple of announcements real quick if anybody's got a quick one.
Pockets of Enthusiasm this weekend. It's on the Tidewater Intergroup website.
Awesome. Thank you, David. Don't think I see any others. Oh, what did I just do?
What I just do, man?
Yeah, I'm messing up my tabs, man. All right. Simple Actions is a home group. If you're interested in joining our home group or in need of a sponsor, please hang out after the meeting. Will all home group members please raise your hands? Awesome. Love you guys. All right. In closing, thanks to all who participated, and I'll unmute everybody after the Lord's Prayer. Give everybody a chance to say thanks to the speaker. And could I get a volunteer to read the last two paragraphs on page 164? BJ, would you mind?
My name's BJ. I'm an alcoholic. And thank you so much, Jeremy. That was extremely powerful. Thanks. Comes from the chapter A Vision for You from the Big Book on page 164. Our book is meant to be suggestive only. We realize we know only a little. God will constantly disclose more to you and to us. Ask him in your morning meditation what you can do each day for the man who is still sick. The answers will come if your own house is in order. But obviously you cannot transmit something you haven't got. See to it that your relationship with him is right, and great events will come to pass for you and countless others. This is the great fact for us. Abandon yourself to God as you understand God. Admit your faults to him and to your fellows. Clear away the wreckage of your past. Give freely of what you find and join us. We shall be with you in the fellowship of the Spirit, and you will surely meet some of us as you trudge the road of happy destiny. May God bless you and keep you until then.
Thanks for reading, BJ. All right. I guess we can do a quick moment of silence and we will close it out with the Lord's Prayer, do a little virtual hug. All right. Our Father, who art in heaven, hallowed be thy name. Thy kingdom come, thy will be done, on earth as it is in heaven. Give us this day our daily bread, and forgive us our trespasses, as we forgive those who trespass against us. And lead us not into temptation, but deliver us from evil. For thine is kingdom, power, and the glory, forever and ever. Amen. Thank you so much, Jeremy. I'm going to just hit this unmute all because apparently
was thank not you, Jeremy. That was
thanks,
wonderful.
Jeremy. That was awesome.
Thanks, guys.